Well, have you ever thought that Jesus is a little bit like Marmite? You either love him or you hate him. But you can't remain neutral. Jesus is a person who divides opinions. If you turn over to John chapter 7, that's where we're going to be concentrating today. And at the beginning of the passage in John 7, we see this. John 7 and verse 1. Jesus went around in Galilee. He did not want to go about in Judea because the Jewish leaders were looking for a way to kill him. They were searching for Jesus in order to do away with him. But in this chapter, there is a more fundamental kind of search that's going on for Jesus. Because everybody had a theory about who he was. In verse 12, among the crowds there was a widespread whispering about him. And some said, he's a good man. And others replied, no, he deceives the people. In verse 20, you are demon-possessed, the crowd answered. In verse 40, on hearing his words, some of the people said, surely this man is the prophet. Others said he is the Messiah. And still others asked, how can the Messiah come from Galilee? Does not the scripture say that the Messiah will come from David's descendants and from Bethlehem, the town where David lived? Thus the people were divided because of Jesus. And even his own family doubted who he was. In verse 5, for even his own brothers did not believe in him. Now what's being identified here in this chapter is that there is a problem as to who Jesus is. And, you know, very often you will see on a church notice board or on one of those car bumper stickers, the phrase that says, whatever the question is, Jesus is the answer. Have you seen that? Yet the question that this chapter raises is, who is this person, Jesus? And it's critical for us to see that Christ is a problem. These people have to do all the theorizing. They have to do all of the searching because they see that he is a problem. Now, if you were to make a list of, say, the 10 people down through history who have had the most influence in this world, then inevitably Jesus Christ would be on that list. And I can tell you that no matter who else you put on that list, he is absolutely unique. He is the only one that will be on that list who claim to be God. Now, of course, people object to that, and some will say, well, how do you know that he claimed to be God? All that we have are legends that have grown up around him. And a lot of people will say, well, we're not even sure that he even existed. And so we can't be sure what he claimed. So how can it be said he would be the only person on that list who claimed to be God? But you know, that's not actually a sound argument. You may have noticed that in recent years, and even I've heard it this year, there have been people that have claimed that the Holocaust never happened. The film Denial touched on that very subject. They say that the Holocaust, the Nazi attempt to exterminate all of the Jews, never took place. Now, the Holocaust that they're talking about, of course, happened some 70 years ago. And the trouble with that kind of false theory is that there are still thousands of people around who were there or who had family who were there. There are eyewitness accounts. There are photographs. There are books that have been written by those who were documenting all of the events that took place. And as a result, that kind of revision of history can't progress. You're going to have to wait at least a couple of hundred years before that kind of theory can get off the ground. Now, Jesus Christ lived and died, and within 20 years, the first Christian documents began circulating. And all of these documents claimed that Jesus Christ died. And that he did great miracles. Now, if those claims were made so close to the event, and if they were false claims, Christianity would never have got off the ground. There was not enough of a time lapse for that to occur. So we know that there is no question on anybody's part that Jesus claimed to be God and that he did miracles. That wasn't in dispute. His enemies agreed to that. His friends agreed to that. That wasn't the problem. The problem is, who is he to say such things, and who is he to do such things? You see, that wouldn't even be a problem if the claims and miracles weren't there. So how do you account for a man who on the one hand claims to be God, and so therefore is some kind of deluded nutcase? And yet on the other hand, he produces such teaching that is of such overwhelming wisdom and character, and attaches that with deeds of such awesome power. You see, that was the problem. And because of that problem, everyone comes up with a theory. And if we are to put Jesus on this elite group of people who have most influenced the world around us, which he undeniably has, it creates a problem not just for the people at the time, but it creates a problem for you and me because of the magnitude of these claims. See, just think for a moment. If you received this morning through the post a registered letter, and it was from HMRC summoning you to court because you owe £100,000 in back taxes. Or supposing this morning in the post you got a registered letter from a solicitor saying, you know, after a long search it's been established that you are the long lost relative of someone who has died and you have just inherited £100,000. What would your reaction be? Would you say, oh, this is a joke? It's a mistake. It's so ridiculous, I'm just going to throw the letter away. Well, you can't just do that, can you? Because as preposterous as it seems, the magnitude of the claim makes it impossible for you to even get through today without investigating the claim, without checking it out. Well, the magnitude of this claim is, here is a man who is able to get onto this elite group of people who have influenced this world, who is the centerpiece of the greatest religion in all of history, and he makes these claims of deity. And so therefore no thoughtful person can afford not to take a really solid look at his claims. And anybody who just dismisses it and says, oh, I'll throw that in the bin, is more foolish than throwing away a letter of an impending court hearing or a notice of a large inheritance that's coming their way. Now, in wrestling with this problem, people come up with four theories of who Jesus is. First of all, they'll say he was a good man. Secondly, they'll say he's a deceiver. Thirdly, they'll say that he is demon-possessed and is a lunatic, or they'll say he is the Christ. They're the only ones that anybody really comes up with. Let me suggest that one of them is impossible, two of them are improbable, and one of them is inescapable. In the early 19th century, there was a Scottish Presbyterian minister who had the nickname of Rabbi Duncan. And one of his most famous quotes was this, that Christ is either deceived, and he deceived mankind through a deliberate fraud, or he was just self-deluded, or he was divine. And he says, there's no way of getting out of this trilemma. It's a great word, that, isn't it? A trilemma. The problem of Christ is he puts us in a trilemma, not a dilemma. A trilemma. Three possibilities. He's either deceiving you and me, or he's insane, he's deluded himself, or he is exactly who he said he is. Now, although there are four theories put forward by these people in John chapter 7, Duncan is right to assume that we are in a trilemma, because one of those theories is an impossibility. But let's look at that first one, the impossible option, that Christ is just a good man. Verse 12, among the crowds there was widespread whispering about him, and some said, well, he is a good man. And down in verse 40, on hearing his words, some of the people said, surely this man is the prophet. Well, it's essentially the same thing. This man is a good moral teacher. This man is a good prophet. Now, why is that such an impossibility? Why does Duncan leave it out of his trilemma? Well, the reason is because of Jesus' extraordinary claims. Because of what he said about himself. Because they were preposterous. They were outlandish. No one else in the history of the world has said the things about himself that he did. And those that have claimed to be God have either been accepted as nothing but a fool or as just a wicked idiot. In chapter 8, the people wanted to stone him because he said, before Abraham was born, I am. And we've heard about this over the last couple of weeks, haven't we? The divine name that Jesus was taking on himself. He took the name of God upon himself, and everybody was absolutely appalled by what he was saying. They wanted to kill him. They knew what he was claiming. During his trial, the high priest said to him, are you the Christ? To which Jesus replied, you said it. And at the end of history, I will appear and I will judge all of mankind. He was constantly making ridiculous statements like that. Jesus was constantly forgiving sin. When Jesus Christ walked over to somebody who had committed adultery against her husband, Jesus says, I forgive you for that adultery. See, what is he assuming when he says that? What is he saying about himself? Well, he's saying, I am the creator, and when you sin, it is primarily against me, and so therefore I am forgiving you of that sin. Jesus also is continually making the most incredible demands for allegiance. He says, it's through me and through me alone that you will find ultimate reality. Because I am the way, the truth and the life to that reality. In fact, I am that reality. If you want to follow me, you must hate your father and your mother and your brother and your sister and your friends. Any devotion to me has to be so much greater than any other devotions that you have to look like hatred in comparison. He said, if you lose me, you lose everything. If you try and retain your life, you're going to lose it. But if you give your life to me, then you will gain life. So he's saying, I am worth so much. If there's anything that is standing in between you and me, get rid of it. If it's your hand, cut it off. If it's your eye, pluck it out. Nothing is worth losing me. And then he has the audacity to comfort us by saying, but don't be afraid, I have overcome the whole universe. Everything will bow down to me in the end, and everything will bow down to you if you come to me. Now let's be reasonable about all of that. No one in the history of the world has said those sort of things who was not dismissed as a crackpot and a bit of a nut. No one else has said things like that. That's the reason why Rabbi Duncan is saying what he says. This isn't one of the options. You can't say he was just a good man. You see, you had Winston Churchill at the time of the Second World War saying, give me your life, but it was for a cause. He said, you have to make the ultimate sacrifice. I have nothing to offer you but blood, toil, tears and sweat. So follow me. But he was saying that for a cause. He was saying that for the sake of our country, for the sake of justice, for the sake of our families. But Jesus, on the other hand, is saying, lose yourself for my sake, for me. And the kind of thing that he is asking for can never be given to someone who's merely human. When anyone has demanded and received that kind of allegiance, it has inevitably led to wickedness and cruelty and to tragedy. I mean, just think of Adolf Hitler. Just think of Jim Jones. They demanded that, and it ended in tragedy. But not in Jesus' case. Because of his claims, you cannot just say he was a good guy. You cannot just say, well, he was a wonderful moral teacher. He doesn't leave you with that option. Now, here are the two improbable options. That Christ is a deceiver, or Christ is insane. Look at verse 12. Others replied, oh, no. He's not a good man. He deceives the people. And then in verse 20, they say, you are demon-possessed. Which is another way of saying that you're insane. You're deranged. You are a lunatic. Now, as much as those two seem to differ, they're basically the same theory. Because what they're saying is he's fooled people. If he's deranged, then he's self-deluded. In the other case, he's actually very wicked because he knows what's going on and he has deliberately deceived people on purpose. And in either case, the theory is he wasn't a good man, but rather he was somebody who deceives people, either wittingly or unwittingly. And he was deceiving them into thinking that he is the Son of God, the divine Son of Man. Now, what is the problem with that theory? Well, simply, it doesn't square with what we know about Jesus' life. Look at verse 45. Finally, the temple guards went back to the chief priests and the Pharisees, who asked them, why did you bring him in? So the chief priests and the Pharisees wanted to know why the temple guards hadn't arrested Jesus. Why didn't you bring him in? And they say, well, he's just a fool. They say, well, don't you know he's just a deceiver? Don't you know he's a bit of a lunatic? Don't you know he's demon-possessed? Well, you see, the trouble is they didn't say any of those things. In verse 46, they said, no one ever spoke the way this man does. And what they're saying is that this man's life and this man's teachings are sublime. This isn't the work of a lunatic. This isn't the work of a deceiver. Just think about his teaching for a moment. G.K. Chesterton said this, if you have found a key lying around your backyard and you picked it up and you tried it out on a number of locks and on one of those locks it opened it perfectly, what would you assume? Though it could be a huge coincidence, he says, you assume that the most rational explanation is that the key was made by the locksmith who made the lock. The key was designed for the lock that it opens. Now, you get to the teachings of Jesus on the Sermon on the Mount, originally given in a pre-modern Oriental society, thousands of years ago, and yet they are found to have such universal validity that in every century, the greatest and the ablest of minds have found fulfillment in what he has taught, that he finds satisfaction in what Jesus has taught. In every century, in virtually every culture, Christianity has taken root. If it's really possible that teachings given in a pre-modern Oriental society have such universal validity, if his teachings match the lock of the human heart, doesn't it make sense that these are not the teachings of a deceiver or of a fool or someone insane? Doesn't it actually make sense that they are devised by the lockmaker themselves? And that's what G.K. Chesterton is arguing. That these teachings were made by the one who designed the human heart. Or you can take a look at his life and take these guards. His life was of such an attractive beauty, of such a perfection, that the people closest to him were fooled by it. Does that make sense? Now you might think, well, how do you know he was so wonderful? How do you know he was such a perfect person? How do you know he had this incredible beauty in his life? And there's a validity to that question, because there are a lot of people who look great to their fans. You know, they have a following and everyone idolises them. And yet, very often, there's always someone quite close to the person who writes a revealing biography. The inside story of what this person is really like. Yet Jesus Christ gets away with something that no one else has ever got away with. Lots of people have claimed to be God. Lots of people have claimed to be perfect. Lots of people have claimed to be divine. But none of them has ever got away with it. No one of them has ever made this elite list of people. Every one of them has been dismissed as a fool or an evil person. But Jesus was different. And why was that? Well, the reason is the people who were closest to him were utterly, utterly convinced that he was who he claimed to be. That's why they lived for him. And that's why they died for him. Nobody was around to blow the whistle on Jesus, because what they saw is what they reported. A complete and an absolute moral beauty. And he combines the virtues that no one else has ever combined. There's a tenderness in Jesus without there being weakness. There's a strength in Jesus without there being any harshness. There's a humility in Jesus without any lack of confidence. There's a holiness and an unbending conviction about Jesus without any lack of approachability. There's the authority that he possesses, but with no self-assertion. There's tremendous courage, but with utter sensitivity. This is the God that the world craves for and that the world needs. And the apostles realized that when they were looking at Jesus, they were looking right into the very essence of who God is. And that's why they were always going around saying, who is this? Who is this that the wind and the sea obey him? Who is this guy? And the answer, as insane as it seems, is less insane than the alternatives. This is the Christ. This is the Son of the living God. And so we come to the inescapable option that Jesus is the Christ. Now the evidence is very telling. But here is where it brings us. Here's where we have to look into our own hearts. You and I know that a lack of evidence can destroy faith, but strong evidence cannot make faith. Let me say that again, because it's easy to just have that go right over us. Poor evidence can destroy our faith, but strong evidence does not make faith. And here's why. There's a lot of things, isn't there, in our life where we've seen the scientific evidence and know that it's bad for us, and yet we go ahead and do it anyway. We know that the things that we eat, and we know that there are practices that we have, some of those things can be really bad for us. We've seen the proof, we've seen the evidence, it's overwhelming, and yet we don't trust ourselves to it. You see, it takes more than the evidence. It takes more than just reason for us to act on it. That's the way the human heart works. It's not enough for us to say, well, just show us the evidence and I'll do it. Not true in any area of our life. Show me the evidence that if I stop eating this, then I won't have a heart attack early in life. And having seen all of the evidence, what do we say to ourselves? Well, one of these years I'll go on a diet. What about all of the evidence that smoking gives us lung cancer? Okay, I'll stop smoking at some point in my life before it gets too late. Show me the evidence, people say, and I'll do it. But so often we don't. Poor evidence destroys faith, but strong evidence does not make it. You have to let the truth address you. You have to let the truth argue with you. You have to let the truth deal with you personally. Now, if it's true that the problem of Christ cannot be answered by any other theory, then the theory that he really was who he said he was, and there's no other way to account for his life and what he said and his claims, what difference should that make to us? Well, here are some important applications that we can make to our heart and to our lives that should really come out of this. And the first one is that Jesus must be an all or nothing proposition. All or nothing. If this is true, it means you have to have all of Jesus or none of him. You see, it's very important for us to know what it means for Jesus to be king, to be Lord of our lives. You know, if I was to knock on somebody's door, you know, you get home after the service today, and I turn up at the door, knock on the door, and you say to me, well, come in, Barry, but stay out, Robbins. I'd have to say to you, well, that's an impossibility. You either get all of me, or you get none of me. I either have to stay out, or I have to come in. You can't have Barry and not Robinson, because I am Barry Robinson. That's who I am. You can't have one without the other. It's all of me. And yet some of us say to Jesus, come in, teacher, but stay out, king. Come in, helper, but stay out, God. Come in, Jesus, but stay out, Christ. And we can't do that. You see in verse 43, as a result of this, the people were divided because of Jesus. And that's inevitable because Jesus is an all or nothing proposition. I once saw an interview on the History Channel, and it was of a European diplomat who had known Hitler personally. And he said there was a weird thing about Hitler. If I was blindfolded and taken into a room, I could tell you whether he was in the room or not, whether he was speaking or not. Because there was an electricity that just sparked off of him. He said all great leaders are like that. There's an inevitability about them. There's a domination about them. He said if you were in Germany when Hitler came on the scene, there was only one of three things that you could do. You could flee from the country and get away from him. You could sell yourself to him, body and soul. Or you could assassinate him. Only one of three things. You don't compromise with a person like that. You can't deal with him. You can't partner a person like that. You're either all for him or you're all against him. You're all in or you're all away from him. Now, if that's true of Hitler, who had leadership gifts, evil ones, but leadership gifts nonetheless, how much more true must it be of Jesus Christ? That's the reason he divides people. When you come into the presence of a great leader, it's all or nothing. When you come into the presence of Christ, it's all or nothing. That's the reason why Jesus can make the incredible statements that he does. You have to hate your father and mother and your brother and sister. And we say, well, how could that be? And what Jesus is saying, well, that's the way I am. That's how you need to relate to me. Jesus said, I didn't come to bring peace on earth, but a sword. And when Jesus was born, the prophecy went, this child will be set for the fall and rising of many in Israel. Fall or rising. That's the way it's going to be. One or the other. It's all or nothing. He's a block of stone, the Bible says. And you either build your whole house on him, or you stub your foot on him painfully. No way round it, because he demands a total reorientation of your life. Absolute obedience. He demands complete, unconditional, unremitting and undiluted allegiance and loyalty. And there's nothing else that you can do. Now here's the test. If you were to ask the average Christian in churches up and down this country, They claim to be Christian, they go to church. And you ask them, well, tell me about your life, tell me how you relate to Jesus Christ. You know, most people would respond in a rather moderate way. They're not scouring the Bible day after day to find out what his will is for them. They're not examining their lives and chucking out the things that are going to harm Christ or displease him. They're not adding the things that he would want in their lives. They're not taking all of their resources, all of their time, all of their money, all of their talents and gifts and putting them at his disposal. They're not wrestling in order to push his values into every part of their life, whether it be at home or whether it be in the public arena. They're not wrestling in prayer day after day so that they can seek his face and his will for them. We can't be moderate when we come to Christ. There's only one of three things that you can do when you're confronted with Jesus. You can run away, you can flee, try and assassinate him, or you can sell your body and soul to him. The scripture says we can't play with Jesus as we would with a little kitten when he is the Lion of Judah. It's all or nothing. So if Jesus is God and he's not just a prophet, a great moral teacher, then secondly, morality and goodness are not enough. And there are a lot of people that will say, well, there are so many different religions, every one of them will take you to God. But we need to look more carefully. Every other religion says morality and goodness are enough. That's because every other religion starts with a founder. Maybe Muhammad or Buddha or Confucius. A prophet or a great moral teacher who says, this is the way. This is the way to get it. This is the way to God, or this is the way to enlightenment. But Jesus comes and says, well, actually, I am God, and I am the way. The prophets say there is a God, and Jesus says, I am God. The prophets say this is the way to reach God, and Jesus says, I've done everything that is needed for you to reach him. The prophets say this is the way, and Jesus says, I am the way. That means that Christianity teaches us that morality and goodness are not enough. If God had just sent us another prophet, we couldn't get to him. God had to send his son to us to do everything that is needed. And what we do is receive him. You can't get to God by climbing up a ladder. God has to come down the ladder to us. And if anyone says, well, I believe any one of these faiths leads to God. What they're saying is, well, actually, morality and goodness is enough. And that rips the heart out of Christianity. Because at its core, Christianity says it's not enough. Salvation is not by your deeds. It's not by your good works. It is by grace alone. That's the only way. And the good news of Christ is what makes Christianity have this irritating exclusiveness. Morality and goodness are not enough, and they don't have to be, because the founder is not simply a prophet, he is God. Now, thirdly, we need to beware of bias when we investigate who Jesus is, because if Jesus is who he says he is, then don't be like the Marxist who says, well, I think of Christ as a revolutionary who brings liberation. Or the artist who thinks, well, Christ is just a prophet against the cultural establishment. We have to see Jesus for who he is. What if you can imagine, you know, there's two flies that are on the back of a cow. And they're having a little discussion. And they're saying, well, what do we do with this cow? What are we to make of this cow that we're on? What do you think this cow is? Now, it doesn't actually matter what they think of the cow. The cow is so much greater than the flies. The job of the flies to adapt to the reality of the cow. For example, stay away from the tail, because if the tail swishes, it's going to knock you right off. It's ridiculous, isn't it, for the flies to sit there and to ask the question, well, what do you think of this cow? Is it a good cow? Bad cow? It's a ridiculous discussion, isn't it? Now, if Jesus is who he says he is, then our opinions of him don't really matter. It's silly for us to ask, well, what do you think of Jesus? What do you like to think about him? Not what we are to make of Christ, it's rather what Christ makes of us. And when we say to him, look, I don't want to hear this, or I don't want to stop that, or I don't want to have to change this in my life, if we feel he doesn't fit in with our preconceived ideas, then I'm going to be out of here, then we've assumed that he couldn't really be who he said he was. Because if he is, who really cares what you or I think about him? There's an ultimate reality that he is God, and we have to adapt to him. It matters what he thinks of us. And if we want to do the investigation into the problem of Jesus in a right way, the instrument is right here. Verse 17. Anyone who chooses to do the will of God will find out whether my teaching comes from God or whether I speak it of my own. See, when the astronomer goes and does his investigation, and when the biologist goes and does his investigation, they use two different instruments, don't they? The astronomer uses a telescope and the biologist uses a microscope. Well, Jesus here is giving us the instrument that we are to use. If we want to find him, if we want to see who he is, we have to be willing to do his will. We have to be willing to do what he says. That's it. And like any fair-minded scientist, we have to say, whatever the conclusion of my investigation is, I'll submit to it. You can't say, well, I'm going to have a look and see what I believe about who this Jesus is, but if it messes up my preconceived ideas, I'm getting out of here. Well, no fair-minded scientist would behave like that. No fair-minded observer would behave like that. And Jesus is saying, if you want to find me, and if you want to resolve the problem, here's the instrument. And it's an infallible instrument. We have to go to him and we have to say, please show yourself to me and I will obey you. I am willing to do whatever it is you want me to do. If you really are who you say you are, show me that you're the real deal. And then we have to read about him in the scriptures. We have to talk about him, talk directly to him. And I wonder, can we do that? With all that's going on in our life and all of the difficulties we experience, all of the trials, can we actually go to Jesus, talk to him, and ask him to reveal more of himself to us with the intention that we're going to obey him? Can we make the truth about who Jesus really is go beyond the evidence so that it sinks deep down inside of us and it becomes a part of who we are? Because if we do that, we'll be just like those temple guards in verse 46. No one has ever spoken the way that this man does. No one. And then for us, the problem of Jesus will be solved. And you'll know in the deepest sense possible that he is who he said he is, that he is God in the flesh, that God has come down to us in the flesh. And that truth has to sink deep inside of us. And that truth has to deal with us so that he becomes all or nothing. Because our morality and our goodness isn't enough. We have to simply run to the embrace of Christ. And there you'll find that this is the place to be. This is a great place to be. Because with all that's going on around us, his grace is fully sufficient. Grace is enough for all of us. Enough for all that we're experiencing. And when we come to that place and we recognize that, we can be eternally grateful. Jesus, Son of God.